Welcome to the Inspiring Social Entrepreneurs Podcast. My name is Fergal Byrne. Every week, I talk to inspiring social entrepreneurs and changemakers dedicated to building a better world. Here, they tell their stories, the highs and the lows, and share what they have learned to help other social entrepreneurs and changemakers on their journey.
So a lot of our focus was actually on dealing with trying to connect development imperatives, which would be around urban poverty, around gender issues, around democracy, around climate change, around planning approaches, etc., etc., and funding those activities. I think it's becoming easier to talk about it, and even our partners rejected this notion, and many of them are actually seeing the fruit of others and the fact of the freedom that has come with organizations that are financially more self-reliant. I think more organizations are going to go this way. I do see some problems. We get asked those all the time. My own board asks them all the time. So, how are you going to ensure that this doesn't run away and just become business? And how are you going to prevent exploitation? I think these are very, very important governance questions.
I'm very pleased today to introduce Larry English. Larry is CEO of REAL, or Real Equity for All, formerly known as Homeless International, a UK-based international development organisation that is dedicated to alleviating housing conditions in informal settlements across the developing world. In the last 5 years, REAL's annual budget to accelerate sustainable housing development in Africa and Asia has increased tenfold to approximately £20 million, and they've been able to increase the number of households helped from 1,000 to 20,000 over that time. Larry has overseen REAL's transformation into a social enterprise, which today operates in 20 countries through 26 entrepreneurial and inspiring community organizations. Thank you very much for taking the time to speak to inspiring social entrepreneurs today. It's a great honor to talk to you and hear your journey. Good place maybe to start would be to tell us a little bit about your own personal journey and how you came to Homeless International.
Okay, I'm trained as an architect and urban designer, planner. I'm South African. I grew up with living in a world where there was rich and poor living in very close proximity. One couldn't live. As an adult, my practice that I ran was in Durban, South Africa, and so we, one could get to work without driving through a slum or an informal settlement, as technically it's called. From being a student, from being a child, I always wanted to be an architect, and I always wanted to. And then when I studied architecture, I realised the role that placemaking. That the physical part of communities can change people's lives, and obviously practice only reinforced that. So I found myself in a situation where we were doing work for government, we were doing work for private sector, we were doing things like waterfronts and replanning of urban areas post-apartheid. But at the same time, I had started. I'd been working with communities directly, mostly my part time. Partly that comes from my own upbringing and religious background. That you can't see a problem and not do something about it. So I was working at the same time as running my own practice. I was also working on Wednesdays. Wednesday evenings and over the weekends, directly with communities, helping them build houses, plan what houses, and these are people living in shacks, and that work eventually became subsumed into Habitat for Humanity. So I found myself part of an international organisation and chairing the Habitat for Humanity in South Africa, and then being on the international board, and then realising that the skills that I developed in South Africa had global relevance, and Habitat for Humanity prompted really being on the board and realizing what the scale of the problem was and the opportunity presented to them. I actually then sold my practice and moved into the third sector, the But because my background, Fugal, you need to tell me when I can blurb, I can talk, forever. So you just interrupt me whenever you want to. The work that I'd been doing in South Africa included things like gated communities and golf course estates, and I'd seen how land in cities appreciated just by the way it was planned, the way it was designed, the way it dealt with the needs of people, the way it dealt with their security needs, particularly in countries like South Africa and Brazil and India, where you have people that are living in places where there's a lot of crime. Security is a big issue, and the people who are most affected by it are actually the poor, not the wealthy. But what I had seen was land values of projects that we were dealing with would increase sometimes 100 times, 200, 300 times the value of the initial inputs. And I thought that, imagine if poor communities could be built the same way. If we could capture the social capital, the sort of a sense of community that exists in informal settlements, the sense of co-creation, sometimes codependency, but the ability to work together, which you couldn't find in the suburbs, if we could capture that. So what I realized was that what I had to offer the developing world was, particularly in urban areas, was how do we capture land market, increase in value of land markets when you do different things to land in urban areas, and increase in value, how could we actually tap that value so that the poor could share in that value in a city and make a city equitable. And so I started that in a project in Durban, Itumbene, and we saw a 25,000 rand house increase in value to 250,000 within 2 years. And that's actually in a Harvard business case study. And then I did the same in Nigeria. And then how I came to Homeless International was, I realized that what we were doing was needed a very small team of people who could work with other, who could work with people in countries, but it needed to be a lot smaller. You needed to work with people who really knew something about real estate, really knew about how to do that creatively, how to do that with communities, with people. How to do that efficiently and quickly, how to actually maximize the yield of land. And then also people understood how you finance that. And so when I came to Homeless International, they had some existing programs running, but what I saw opportunity to do, it was a much, much smaller organization. Was the opportunity to work with partners in countries to establish very effective non-profit organizations that could actually make profit and redeploy that profit, one, to sustain themselves, but also then to share that that increased value with the communities, participating communities. And that has seen our work grow tremendously. Once people realise that people on the ground or an individual family actually own a house, that house increases in value, all their investment is not. You can improve a house in a slum, but the slum will bring its value down because it's a great. Significant construction value, but it has no market value because the surrounding area actually brings its value down. So working with communities and building whole communities is very important because the value of your house depends on the value of the house next door, depends on the behaviors of the house, the community in which you live. And so we attentive approach, which is sort of holistic, but building estates, building, doing housing in a way where you're always thinking about the value that it creates and the value then that accrues to an individual family, which allows them to become, you know, more secure financially, but also, you know, to be able to provide some collateral against which they can borrow and, you know, send kids to university or start a business or do something like that. So,
okay, that's very interesting. And what kind of scale of activity have you had? I mean, how do you measure, you know, what Homeless International has done in the last few years?
What Homeless International has done is, I mean, what existed before I arrived, and so therefore I can take no credit for it, is the organization focused on supporting organizations around the world that were mobilizing slum dwellers. That means they were organizing slum dwellers into representative groups. You know, so they are, and I come from a planning background and have had problems, have had difficulties in the past where there's a place called Inanda in Durban where you had, I don't know, estimated about 600,000 people living there, and you've got to, the area needs to be replanned. Well, you know, who do you speak to? Who represents all these people? And it could be hundreds of different groups, hundreds of different factions. So unless communities that are living in slums are organized, it's very difficult for outside agencies, you know, responsible for water, sanitation, planning, et cetera, to actually work with those communities, because to improve them requires some kind of coherence, some kind of collaborative effort. And so Homeless International had focused for about 19 years on building, working with organizations around the world, in Africa and Asia mainly, working with slum dweller groups like Slum Dwellers International and Asian Coalition for Housing Rights, and essentially with working with people in country, organizing people in slums, you organize them in slums and federate them in at a city level, federate them at a national level, so you actually eventually have a group of organized people of which you know their names, you know you have kind of data. The data is collected by the organizers around, you know, how many people live here, how many men and women, what do you earn, what are your vulnerabilities, what are your priorities, all this kind of information is actually held in. And if I had to take the partners that we support, we probably have about 3.5 million people that exist in these groups. But taking a group from you know, a group that is organized. Sorry, and one of the things I missed was the organizing principle is, you know, people organize often, they can organize out of a crisis. You know, someone might say you might be living there, but we're going to evict you and move you somewhere else. And so suddenly there's the need to work together. So solidarity can be built through crisis. But mostly the methodology used amongst our partners is to start savings groups and to undertake slum-wide enumeration exercises. That means they actually use GPS mapping for using Google Maps and GPS each person's house or shack, and from that actually able to establish a map, and then from that map we're able to to give families to locate families, but then also to produce data associated with those family census data. So that's what we call mapping and enumeration. And these exercises are very useful to bringing communities together. And so that work was what Homeless International did and continues to do. Our organization continues to support that. But the challenge was, well, how do you then service that community? How do you, you know, so let's say 10,000 people or 1,000 people have actually organized themselves. How do you start working to replan the area or provide water and sanitation or housing or move them to a new area, perhaps they're all living in a floodplain or under electric, transmission lines. So what we needed to do, the challenge was, how do you build an organization that actually services that need? And I suppose what we've realized is that if you know the history of sort of urban development or housing, you'll know that for about in 1980, the World Bank, really largely led by the World Bank, decided that housing was a private good, so therefore needed to be provided by the private sector. And so up to that stage, governments around the world were quite heavily involved in urban planning, expanding the cities, providing for new, for people urbanizing. They would procure land and subdivide it and provide lots of people coming in. But post-1980, World Bank funding was withdrawn from the prevailing wisdom at the time suggested that the private sector should be providing housing and that government really should play an enabling role. Well, the consequence of all of that is that local governments around the world, particularly developing countries, housing departments started getting money from the World Bank. The local governments who are dependent on those funds to plan new areas and to put infrastructure in, eventually atrophied. And so today you actually find that local governments in developing countries, even in some of the major cities, are pretty dysfunctional and under-resourced. So that has happened at the same time as over the last 30 years, as urbanization has peaked, and so you've had this rush into cities. So now we're in the city, and all along, the private sector never really came to the party. So for the private sector, this was too risky. This is not a market that people understand. And so neither government nor the private sector, and I'm being very generalizing it, are able to provide for the poor. One, the private sector don't understand the market, they don't understand the vulnerabilities of poor, they don't understand how they earn their incomes, they don't have payrolls, etc., etc. And generally the private sector only really get involved in low-cost housing when the government is willing to guarantee it, or there's some kind of funding for it. Governments long ago stopped providing housing. So what we have is a huge market between, almost 1.4 billion people now, and provision. So there's a huge market there. So when you talk about scale, so our focus has been building social enterprises, or what we call community development enterprises, to bridge that gap. Organizations that understand the market, that understand people living in slums, that have the trust of those people, can organize them in hundreds, and then building institutions then that are able to plan and implement housing projects, water sanitation projects, and finance them. Finance not just the project, but finance the end user that wants to then buy that house or buy that water and sanitation product. So that's really the scale. To answer your question about the scale, we were building about 600. Us and our partners. All our partners are independent of us, so they become independent organizations. We were building about 600 units a year, and this year we will do about 20,000 units. Now, that doesn't sound great in terms of the deficit, but when you think that people are building these houses in a sustainable way, once you get to about 500 housing units a year, as an organization, you can break even financially. Once you get to about 1,000 units a year, you start earning surpluses, which means that you can actually go and buy land and you can actually start to engage in the market. The scale of our program has gone from about £6 million to about we have about committed funds of about £100 million now.
Wow. That's quite a growth.
So, but when you're doing housing, water and sanitation, these are capital projects. So when you compare the cost of mosquito net to what we're doing, you know, it's not comparable. It's apples and pears kind of thing. But if you think that depending on who you work with, and we're working with some academics at the moment, economists to assess it for ourselves. But when you think of when you build a house, the downside and upside value chains. The additional value that it creates is, if you read McKinsey, he said about 12 times. So for every dollar you invest, you create $12 of opportunity. We're trying to verify that. We've heard in India about 8 times, in Philippines about 16 times. So when you think of the fact that you're going to redeploy these funds, and that because of the property market, you're adding value all the time. Our aim at the moment, we're working on a model which enables an organization to move from to sustainability and self-reliance within the 3 to 5 year period. And so essentially our scale-up approach is how do these organizations scale up, not how do we produce more housing, but how do we produce more organizations that produce more housing? And as the private sector, you know, obviously as the organizations scale up, so they get to the thousands of houses a year, suddenly the scales of economy of scale is such that that banks become interested, that other private investors become interested. And that's really our challenge now. Our challenge is, if you think of a canal system, our challenge is to ensure that the canals remain full of water, which means that now you might be able to secure funds locally to ensure that your pipeline is pump primed financially, but to keep your projects going, yeah? Because obviously if you stop, then you have people that are, you know, lots of people that are working that need to be paid, that, you know, but there's no production. So you've got to keep the thing, you've got to keep the pipelines moving. So to increase, so our role in Homes, here in Homes International is we're building a fund which would serve as that kind of reservoir at the top of the hill, that if, you know, if you can't find funding locally, we can ensure that there are funds available. And so the challenge ahead of us is proving this market, proving the returns on investment, and then expanding the number of investors. That's the challenge. On the ground, we find that we started off in 2010. We had 3 partners that were employing this methodology or approach, this sort of enterprise approach. We now have 15. By 2018, we should have about 50. So, and obviously they can expand in country as well. But so scale will be, essentially we feel that without demeaning it, it's a kind of a sort of a Starbucks approach to housing. You know, once you've got an organization that can actually provide land, housing, and basic infrastructure, that means basic water and basic sanitation, and they can do that sustainably, then that institution or that little organization can be replicated. And the only thing, and that's really, that's for us sitting in the UK, that's our challenge. Our challenge is how do you expand the number of these partners. For partners on the ground, it's how do they expand their rate of delivery.
Can you tell me a little bit about the financial side of it? I mean, I've read a little bit about the background, and you were talking about how you've been funded before and how you've over time tried to, I guess, move away from a more grant model. And, you know, I mentioned VPF. Can you tell me a little bit about how the organization has changed and how its funding has changed over time?
Okay, let me be very upfront. A lot of our work, we are still very much grant funded. What has changed is the way we funded and the scale of our funding. So in the beginning, there's aid agencies around the world are increasingly moving toward more sustainable models of delivery. We just happen to be ahead of that curve. And so I need to credit, the Swedish government, SIDA, and DFID, the British government, who have been instrumental. Often this sort of social enterprise discussion is about a single person. Well, I can tell you now, it's not about. I think individuals are important. I won't be so humble as to say that ideas aren't important, but I think putting those ideas into practice requires a whole range of people who think in similar ways. And we've been fortunate that we've had people in DFID and in Swedish SIDA that have seen what we're doing, seen what the partners are doing, believed in it, and actually provided further funding. Our challenge in moving into private sector is quite minimal at the moment. I just need to say that because those are the facts. Our challenge is moving to the private sector. What we found is moving in this direction, you weren't really collecting all the data. A lot of the systems that we developed were rudimentary systems that worked for ourselves, but certainly wouldn't work in the international world of finance. So I'll start at the beginning. So we've got a lot of work to do in terms of building and tightening systems. And those systems are at every level. It's how project. How do we select partners in different countries? How do they select projects? How do beneficiaries get selected? How do you procure? Your materials. How do you procure professional services? How do people? When you start working with government, how do you ensure that there's no corruption? All these different things are systems that we've got to work on. So that's sort of the technical side. There's a huge technical challenge because you will know that if you look at where mafia operates, whatever becomes a mafia tends to be around construction, around sort of government contracts like refuse collection, etc., etc. These are the kinds of land that is owned by government. The real estate sector has become a way of laundering, Somali pirate money and drug money. So when you're seeking private sector investment at the lower end where we're at, which is the bottom 40% of the pyramid, you've got to build very strong systems. So we have huge challenges there, but we have great people working with us. But if you had to ask me, if I have to answer your question around the challenges, I think that moving from it was like changing a religion. it was, you believe certain things are right and wrong, and now someone is telling you that that's not the way to think. That is, what you think is right is not really right, and what you think is wrong is not really wrong.
Can you give me maybe an example of where you started out? If you just maybe just simplify how you were funded before you went on this project, just maybe how things worked simply, in terms of your finances, and just maybe where you are today. And then we can talk about that journey, but just kind of give a kind of slightly synoptic kind of overview so I get a sense of it, Jem.
Okay, well, most of our funding was distributive. So basically, we're an agency in the UK that has identified unique needs and unique organizations in developing countries where there's a need which aligns with the development priority or imperative of either comic relief or DFID or Big Lottery or other agencies. And our organization, by the way, is rooted in the social housing sector. So we would also go to housing associations in the UK who would identify with some of those causes. But the idea was essentially – we are a wealthy country, and because we are wealthy, there's an imperative upon us to distribute that wealth. And I'm not contesting that. It's a particular worldview, and a lot of aid is based on that, you know, that out of the wealth of Britain, we will distribute around the world to those countries in need. And I think it's great for our national conscience that we're engaged in that. But when you're distributing money and there's no need for it to come back to you, it doesn't require certain disciplines. It requires a very, you know, not to say that the money is just wasted, I'm not saying that at all, is that it would be done on a program that a lot of our money was put in programs and then it would be evaluated as to whether the impact is being achieved, etc., etc. And that's largely still how aid works. The difference for us is that we are essentially an organization that was started not to focus on the symptoms of poverty, urban poverty. You know, there was clearly a housing focus when we started, you know, but housing doesn't get funded, you see. So we call it the H word. You know, people don't believe it's a private good. When you build a house, it's for an individual family. When you build a railroad, it's for everybody. You know, that's the difference, essentially. When you do water and sanitation, supposedly it's for everybody. When you do a house, it's for an individual. So if you're an aid agency, you don't want to put your money into things that benefit individuals. What you want to do is put your money into things which benefit the maximum amount of people. So, you know, boreholes, public toilets, roads, etc., etc. So that placed a dilemma on us. So a lot of our focus was actually on dealing with trying to connect development imperatives, which would be around urban poverty, around gender issues, around democracy, around you know, climate change, around you know, building you know, participatory planning approaches, etc., etc., and funding those activities, but not necessarily investing in a land market, you know, in actually building an organization that can finance itself. So one of the challenges we had was in India, where India, you know, working in a city like Mumbai, and I hope they never get to hear this, but so this is a city with more millionaires than any other city. It's got Bollywood, but here you are working with the people at the other end, and you're working with an organization that is dealing with, you know, the housing problem, housing or slums are like a scab, you know, they're like a surface wound or a sore that is, so that's a physical manifestation of a whole range of underlying problems, diseases, and those diseases can be how land is owned and distributed, whether certain ethnic groups can get access to it, whether people actually care for the poor, where they want them to return to the rural areas from which they supposedly came, etc., etc. There's a whole range of reasons. A lack of access to finance, inability to you know, to having regulations that make the technologies too expensive to use, etc., etc. There's a whole range of reasons why slums exist. And so we were working, but a lot of that has to do with our regulatory. A lot of the approaches to changing these underlying contributing factors or determinants of why people are homeless take years to deal with. And when you're working as a UK organization in a country, working through a partner, you know, and you have to say, well, we're trying to get to this nirvana, this state where the poor now don't have any obstacles to overcome. They can all access housing. Everything is equal. You know, access is equal to all. When do you get to that point? And, you know, in a sense, the approach we had was very much trying to change that, trying to help an organization change the context in which it was operating and deal with these issues. And I felt in India, knowing that sentiments in the UK, you know, people began asking the questions, why are you funding in the UK? Why, you know, we're losing jobs. India's economy is booming. Why don't they deal with themselves, etc.? And a lot of those things, a lot of those issues became very difficult to deal with. And so when we had the conversation with our partners and asked them, well, how long will it take to change all of this? The answer was, well, we don't know. You know, so how do you sustain a program which is advocating for change, where the change might take place in 25, 50, 100 years? You know? A lot of the causes of poverty in India are deep-rooted. They're deep-rooted in culture and the way the society is structured. It goes back to, you know, millennia. So how do we deal with that from the UK, and how do we sustain sourcing funds in this country to help that advocacy to continue? So that was one of the dilemmas that we faced, is that we needed to change from being a distributive to being a to where we were investing in something that developed and actually no longer required us, no longer needed us. So working with our partners, that was the big change, was how do we make our partners sustainable so that this advocacy work can continue as long as it needs to, and be resourced locally rather than resourced, you know, or be dependent on local, on international aid. So I suppose it was like moving from a situation where we were funding pot plants which had to be watered from a hose pipe connected to the UK to a situation where we needed to take that plant out of the pot plant and plant it into the soil so that it could actually find its own groundwater. And one of the unique advantages that we had, you know, was that we were working within the property, the infrastructure, the land market, and there were ways where we could create value that would allow an organization to become financially independent. And so there was a real shift in, we haven't stopped anything we're doing, we still continue to do that, but about 90% of our work now is actually building organizations that will be around 50 to 100 years from now. That's really
right, very far-sighted, inevitably, not just in terms of time, but I suppose in terms of the model that you're operating with. And you mentioned that this is a very different worldview, in a sense, from the one that you were operating in before. Can you characterize maybe a little bit the difference in how you see things?
Well, I think what happened was, You can hear from my accent, I'm from South Africa. So for me, I did all my work in Africa and the Middle East, and then I come to the UK. And the UK had always been that other, you know, it had always been the source of some of the financial support we were getting. And so now I was on the other side. So in some ways, the role that we were playing was that of, and I don't mean to demean international aid, but essentially we were fundraisers, we were grant procurers. We could, because of the relationship we had with partners in the developing South, we were able to identify their needs and then identify donors that would support it. Essentially, we would be that kind of e-harmony between need and supply financially. What we had to do was the question that we asked ourselves was, what do you do in the UK? So now we have a set of partners out there that are actually going to start building houses and provide water and sanitation in increasing scale. And we were going to support them to build a self-sustaining organization. And so the shift one was technical, how you can help to build those organizations. What kind of skill sets are now required to actually build a self-sustaining or an enterprise, as opposed to an NGO, which is really like a distribution center. So what technical skills are going to require to build organizations? What technical skills are required to actually procure finance in increasing amounts? What role can you play? What can you do in the UK that you can't do in say, Kenya? So in Kenya, you can build the houses. In Kenya, you can build well, the technical and the project management skills, and that's where those are needed. So what do you do in the UK? Well, the UK is a great source of repository of knowledge around housing and financing housing. It's one of the countries in the world, apart from where social housing is privately financed to the tune of about 85%. So 85% of housing in this country, provided social housing, is privately financed. So there's a range of expertise here that we've drawn on. Funding is cheaper in this country, and always will be. So so you can source the cheapest sources of finance in this country. And so I suppose what we started looking at is rather looking at that we are the North that have the resources and the South that need the resources, and it's sort of a North-South relationship between people who have money and those who don't. Ours became more of a symbiotic relationship of what can they do that we depended on to drive sort of our mission, and what can we do for them that helps to drive their mission. And so it became much more symbiotic. And so we've moved to so we needed to become, the challenge for us is we needed to become a lot more savvy around the financial and technical skills, built environment skills around real estate development, land markets, finance markets, etc., etc. I mean, and I, if you want me, I can send you a whole model of the kind of competencies that are required at our level and also at the level of a partner. So the challenge for us is we move from a kind of a generic, although urban focused aid agency, to one which was now actually focused on the building of organizations that build houses. That's really our strapline. We build organizations that build houses. And then the shift has been, you know, moving from, the you know, people who are very much, you know, which had a generic skill set of how does international aid work, how do aid agencies work, how do you, you know, the kind of what we call dev speak, development speak, of how do you actually apply for grants, how do you actually apply with it with using the right terminology, which is a skill set if people don't understand it. I mean, if you've got opportunity for 10 grants and there are, you know, 500 applicants, if you have a spelling mistake, if you use the wrong terminology, those could be reasons for not funding you. So it's a very competitive game. But we had to move from that to more of a to build our technical capabilities, and that's sort of what we've done. We also, the other things that changed was the language around those two. So moving from a language of international development or aid to one of building of social enterprise. Of we had to have some sort of transition language. We didn't refer to profit. We used the word surplus. We didn't refer to a word loan. We used the word a returnable fund. the challenge was, and then there are a lot of challenges. People get into the third sector or into the, you know, they go off and do a master's. They're pretty bright people to start with, go and do a master's in Manchester or SOAS or Durham or whatever, and their career, they've got the right skills to work in international aid. Suddenly they find themselves working for an organization that's now talking about return on investment, investment yields, and a whole range. I don't want to get into all the technical language, but essentially it's a different kind of language. You know, some people that you talk to, we never even used to use the word beneficiary. We would never refer to someone using a passive word term like beneficiary, because it's, so we'd used to use the word, you know, communities. We still use the word communities, but sometimes we'll use the word clients. I don't know if I'm answering your question, but there's the changing of religion part was, when we started talking about charging interest on loans, people said, well, how can we charge interest? How could people that are so poor repay? You know, and our partners were challenged with having to, I suppose the scenario could be likened to having to choose communities that would work, you know, that would be able to pay. You know, it's like starting a store, a shop, and selling all your products at discount. And you know that you're not going to last a week if you do that. So you now have got to start charging for some of them, and that means that some people won't be able to afford what you're charging, which means you start having to exclude. And it's a bit like a doctor walking into a hall full of people that have just been wheeled in from a bomb blast. And they've got to choose the people that have the best chance of survival. You know, it's that kind of choice. There are millions of people that are poor, but when you're wanting to build an organization that's sustainable, you've got to now make a choice as to who do you serve. And so that choice is a tension between need and ability to repay. And I suppose the change has been, we don't see Homeless International no longer sees itself as the welfare agency. We build welfare agencies. So the decision around welfare and how poor people go and how they serve the poorest is a decision that our partners make in country. We don't make that decision for them. So all of those kinds of are real shifts, you know.
It's very interesting because it's something that more traditional type, I guess, grant-funded organizations may have to make or may well be interested in making, a journey that others will be doing. Can you give me a sense of how do you do this? I mean, this is a major cultural shift. It's a very different way of looking at things. So what are two or three things that you have learned on this journey you think are important in order to make this journey?
I think I sometimes look back and just think, you know, I've been with Homeless International for 6.5 years now. And I sometimes wonder, could we have got to where we are now within 3 years? You know, I think that I learned somebody actually came up with this thing of 100 days, you know, so you don't criticize what people are doing until you understand what it is they're doing. And I think that we had lots and lots of conversations in this organization around what would happen if we cease to exist. You know, what is our purpose? Who invited us to be in a country? I don't know if you've ever read an article written some years ago called The Missionary Position, you know. And it's obviously it's talking about the missionaries and what they call the secular missionaries, really the aid agencies that have been around for 60 years in countries post independence. But it's also talking about who's on top, you know. And we start asking ourselves questions, and I think it was a dialogue. I think it was very important for me was to move forward with consensus. And to move, you know, when you come to an organization that is incredibly intelligent people who are really doing what they're doing very well. I didn't come to an organization that was failing. I think I just felt that we had greater potential. We were engaged with our partners at even greater potential. So how do you bring people with you? So I think it was a lot of conversations and a lot of questioning about what are we leaving behind? You know, if we cease to exist and we had a partner and we were unable to fund them, you know, they would dry up and die in a way unless they had other sources of funding. When you started looking at countries, at the aid agencies, you know, as a country moves through the DAC list, I assume you're familiar with the OECD countries, you know, their sort of columns and from very poor countries to middle-income countries to, you know, so it's four columns. And the aid agencies tend to focus, I'm talking about the statutory-funded aid agencies like DFID and CEDA and USAID will fund the poorest countries. But as a country moves away, you know, people might still be poor living in a country that now is wealthier and your partner's working in that country and suddenly we are unable to fund them because there are no sources of funding anymore. And India's point is a case in point. So the challenge to ourselves, well, now what are we going to do? What do we do with this? You know, because essentially we set up a relationship where we are their source. We are essentially, they've now become dependent on us. How could this possibly be development?
Yes.
You know, people will criticize missionaries, but at least they left schools behind. You know, they'll criticize colonialism, but at least they left, you know, municipalities and railroads and whatever behind. I'm not being so romantic as to think that they'll leave a whole range of other awful things behind that we still deal with. But if the aid agencies have to start to question themselves, what are we leaving behind other than a retrenchment package? You know, so I often think that the institutions that we're building are squatting in the spaces of genuine institutions. And I think that the social enterprise sector, whilst there's a lot that we can criticize it for, you know, I don't know sometimes whether these are actually focused on the poor or focused on CSR or focused on marketing. But I think we have to ask ourselves, what is development? What are we leaving behind that doesn't need us? And I think that's the challenge we had. And I think when intelligent people start to ask themselves that question, as one of my colleagues did, you know, we found it very difficult to answer. And so that and I remember having a conversation with. We didn't feel in a way that I suppose the there is this belief that a lot of development in the post-colonial times was, in, you know, newly independent countries was very top-down. And then through the 80s, particularly in the 90s, we began to become sensitive and started listening to to bottom-up processes. You know, and I think that so top-down was replaced with bottom-up. And I think that we as Homes International were very much a bottom-up organization where we listened to what our partners had to say, you know, and some of the ideas that they had. And I think it was a very good thing. But it can become so entrenched that you don't question anything. You know, you don't question what your partners are doing. And we were in relationships with partners where our partnership had never been put down on paper as to what we were actually doing together. And I remember an instance where I started asking that we put these partnerships down on paper. You know, why are we a British organization partnering with you, a Kenyan organization? What are we doing together that we couldn't do independently? And why did we make the choice, unlike other organizations? We didn't, as Homeless International, go and create Homeless International Kenya, Homeless International Uganda, Homeless International whatever. We didn't flap our flag in the wind in all these countries and seek to create a global brand. We worked with independent partners, which is a huge strength. But we didn't have partnership agreements, and because what we were doing was really responding to this bottom-up, what people were telling us. And I think that still exists. We still are very good listeners as institutionally, but we didn't have anything on paper as to what our partnerships were about. And so I had to there was an occasion where all our partners had got together at a conference in Southern Africa, and they were asking me, because they were all together. It was a Skype call just like this. They were all connected. And by the way, most of our the organizations we support are women-led. That is just because women are better at building solidarity than men are. And so they tend to be women-led. It's not a rule. It's just status quo. And so most of our partners on the other line were actually saying, Larry, why are you doing this? You know, after many, many years, we've been partners for many years. We've never needed to put it on paper, etc. And I said, well, reason is I could drop dead and someone else comes along, and just as I have, and I don't really know what the partnership's about. So I think it's important to write it down so that anybody else that picks up the partnership knows what we were trying to do in the beginning. And I said, you know, all of you are women. and I don't mean to get sexist about this, but I said, you know, if you were in a relationship with someone for 10 years, you know, wouldn't you ask where the relationship is going? And so that's all I'm asking. You know, I don't know sometimes whether the relationship we have, or the partnership we have with organizations, is a one-night stand, is it a dating relationship, is it an engagement or a marriage? Because I think that if we're going to build organizations on the ground that last, there has to be a relationship that's willing to go through thick and thin. So, you know, call it what you like, and I don't care which side of the, of that debate but you need to have some kind of contract that describes what you're trying to do, and that allows both parties to invest a lot in that relationship. So I'm not going to walk up and down, bust my gut, and make a fool of myself, in some cases, with shaking a tin, raising money for people with whom I've got a one-night stand, you know. So so that relationship between our partners had to become a lot more solid, a lot more clear, and the roadmap developed for that. And that was a change in our organization as well, is that you had to start becoming a lot more clearer as to what the blueprint was, or what is the game plan as to how this organization is going to be built. And once that in place, how do we do that? How do we make that building process a shorter process each time? Oldest partner we have is 25 years, you know, and they got to, I suppose, a level of sustainability about seven years ago. How do you do something that took you 20 years? How do you do that in 3 or 5?
That's very, very interesting. I mean, just changing gear slightly. Yeah. I mean, would you say that, I mean, is it too simplistic to say the organization has gone from being a charity to a social enterprise?
We are a social, but we still retain the, and this is very important if some people are going to listen to this out there. We are still the same organization. You know, our mission is not our method. You know, our method is not our mission. So for us, we're a social enterprise. We have an enterprising approach to building organizations. Yes, the shift was. But we haven't lost the fact that there is advocacy challenges, there are huge injustices. So we still have a part of our organization that still focuses on that. It hasn't diminished. It's just that the rest of the organization has grown much bigger than that part. You could say it's the state of, as the wind blew as a result of the global financial crisis, you know, suddenly people's sentiments change color. You know, and so social enterprise is some, you know, people have, you know, I wouldn't want to say it's a sort of a compassion index or anything like that, but I think that people are looking a little bit more carefully at what is happening with the money and how is it being deployed, and how are people becoming, you know, independent, and how is this going to end. And I think that those kind of questions are asked now, weren't asked in the heady days of, up till 2007, you know. So, a limitation on resources makes us think more strategically. So we were really doing it, but I do think that, you know, the wind has blown, and we happen to have our sail up and catch it.
Right. And again, just trying to really distill this, because it's very interesting. What would you say are a few of the key characteristics of this more enterprising approach in an organizational form?
It's really important for us to know why we're doing what we're doing, why we exist. You know, what is the problem that we're trying to change? So obviously that's, you know, it depends on where you start. But so assuming you've identified a problem in the world that is not being addressed, what is the process that is going to change it? And I tend to think ecosystemically, so one has to sort of understand it like a doctor would do. You know, if my foot is sore, what is causing the pain? And then actually understand the anatomy to actually fix up that pain. So I described earlier that, you know, so it's important for us to find out what is the dysfunction, or the, as some people call it, the market failure, or you know, what is that dysfunction you're trying to change, and what is it ecosystemically? So it's not. So what I see a lot of, and I see even at Skoll, and I don't mind being public about it, is a lot of silver bullets. So you might solve one problem and create another. You know, and so I think it's very important to understand the ecosystem. So if you're in the medical sphere and you're dealing with HIV, as people are in that arena, they understand the entire ecosystem, how it causes, etc., how it spread, etc. And I think that other sectors or subsectors need to be understood the same way. So, and I think it's very important to understand that sector. And then it's important for us to understand where we fit in that sector and how we add value to that. And then how is there any and then to choose, obviously you need, if you think of it ecosystemically or as a hybrid value chain or as a linear value chain, what are the components in that value chain? And then do they understand the whole or do they understand just parts? And I think that if you can, and I think for me is when everybody begins to understand where they fit in that chain and understand how they add value to it, or not adding value to it, and then how that chain or that loop in our case creates accountability as to whether you're doing your bit effectively or not effectively, then as an organization you start to know how you can invest, where you invest. You stop becoming a chicken without a head. You start knowing, okay, this is what we've got to do, these are the competencies we've got to develop whether we like it or not, and these are the languages we have to acquire, and I use that metaphorically. In our case, we've had to learn finance language. The banks aren't going to come to us. We've got to go to the banks, I often have this a lot of people with an advocacy bent who are kind of saying, well, the finance sector needs to understand what we're doing. And you kind of say, well, you're speaking to me in English, and I know that's not your first language. Why did you learn English? Well, if you don't learn English, there's no ways you're going to get funded. Because the funding comes out of relationships, it comes out of submitting grants. If you can't do that in English, you don't get the grants. So if you want to be helpful to a whole bunch of people that don't speak English, learn English, because it's going to get people money. So we're faced with the same thing, having to learn different languages. So what did I say? I said knowing the ecosystem, knowing our role in the ecosystem, and then becoming bloody good at what we do and better than everyone else. And I think in the end, all of us want to. I think in some ways, the social enterprise or working for the charities is like a new way of like Victorian virtues. It's like a way of acquiring being virtuous. You sit next to someone on a plane, you tell them you work with people who in slum, working in slums, and they say, "Oh, that's a wonderful job," and you get this warm, feel this warm glow coming across you as to, because you're doing this wonderful work. And I think a lot of people are attracted to that, and I don't mind actually not earning a banker salary to actually earn to do this kind of work just because of that warm glow. But I think that and I think that social enterprise in some ways is offering people the same warm glow without an ability to make money at the same time. But someone else can evaluate that. But at an organizational level, you're looking at what you're doing and saying, is this organization providing something people are willing to pay for? And it's, and somehow when they pay for it, it has a value. When they don't pay for it, it doesn't have a value. I think you've probably heard that many times. But and they're willing to, and then if you can scale it up, that even yourself, you can be paid by doing this work, And I think that, I don't think that you can make this work for everyone. I think there's some people people that are orphaned or people who are aged, just unable to work. You can't sort of say this is going to work universally, but there are billions in the world that are able to pay for something, and so if you're able to find a way of attending to their need in a way that it can be provided sustainably, I think that enterprise challenges you more to think about the sustainability aspect than aid would, because you can find a theoretical way, you can do an evaluative thing, which you can do in studies which show improvement, but don't require the same kind of sharpening of thinking. And then at a macro level of looking at your life, I think that you want to leave behind. I mean, you've chosen to join a sector where this is not a way of becoming rich. So if you're going to do this work and you want to look back at your life, you want to actually know that you actually did something that actually did work. I mean, I would like to look at organizations that are continuing to be effective, that will be effective by, you know, beyond me dying, you know, and that is very important to me. If I'm mucking about playing aid and trying to impress my friends with trumped up figures and playing that kind of game, well, that's just a game. I'd rather go back to the private sector and money. I don't want to play that game. I think that's from a personal point of view. I think that's the shift in the organization. We don't exist here to play some game. Even people refer to the aid industry. Why did it become an industry? You know, why is it an industry? You know, it's a
right.
And now the industry is actually focused on its own survival.
You've suggested some caveats, and that others may, you know, that there are questions and some nuanced thinking that's required about social enterprise. Trying to just get a sense of looking at the charities sector in general, to what extent do you think over the next 5-7 years, more charities are going to be going down this route, or more of the kind of services that are currently, put it this way, more of the beneficiaries will be delivered services through more social enterprise type organizations, if that makes sense?
I think that's already happening. I mean, I'm part of a group of organizations who, it was interesting, I was joking with a couple of them the other day, because for the first time, we're actually going to be talking about what we're doing, and actually, it's a small group of organizations, and two other organizations happen to be following the similar route, but all of us come from a completely different background. You know, we would never, this would have been heresy. And we've talked about it as a coming out session. and it is, because I think it's becoming easier to talk about it. And even our partners rejected this notion, and many of them are actually seeing the fruit of others and the fact of freedom that has come with organizations that are financially more self-reliant. So they're no longer so for me, I think more organizations are going to go this way. I do see problems. We get asked those all the time. My own board asks it all the time. So how are you going to ensure that this doesn't run away and just become business, and how are you going to prevent exploitation? I think these are very, very important governance questions, the people at VPF will tell you that now, this is the role that I think that VPF and similar hubs can play in what do we put in place. You know, at the moment in the UK, we're not regulated. We're not a charity. I mean, sadly, the Charity Commission in this country doesn't distinguish between the local Daffodil Society and the international NGO. You know, it's working in multi-countries. It's the same rules that apply for governance. And yet, this is going to be require tremendous governance. We do have examples. You know, the social housing sector has the HCA. It has its own regulatory body. It's both a charity, but it's also a business. And I think this is going to be the... So for me, pointing forward, I don't want to get too euphoric about it. I think that it's solving some problems and creating new ones. And the new ones are going to be, how do you hire somebody? I mean, that's one of our challenges. How do we hire somebody that thinks like an entrepreneur, that is hugely ambitious, but unselfish about it? It's not going to be for themselves. They're not going to personally benefit by it. Where do you find those kinds of people? You know, so not somebody who's sitting there, you know, sort of thinking that basically their role is to feel immensely compassionate the whole time, and feels that all they need to do is have the right quotient of compassion. But actually, somebody who actually is an entrepreneur that's going to go out and do something, but they're not personally going to, there's not going to be a direct relationship between how hard they work and how much they what their bank balance looks like. So I don't know if that's what you want, but for me, I still think we're in the middle of all of it. That's why I feel that talking about these huge successes, I still think that there are every corner we turn, every time the horizon changes, we kind of see a whole new landscape in front of us, which is filled both with opportunities and new challenges. So governance for us as an organization has become tremendously important, and I'm fortunate to have a board chair who that actually really understands it, understands that we're trying to balance the poor who are becoming poorer around the world, and mechanisms that are trying to use the best of business, you know, and bridging these two, and finding ourselves often between having to develop, because we're dealing with it, you know. But the future is, you know, in the future, our organization will be led by different people. You know, how do those values a lot of the management that takes place, a lot of the integrity of our organization is based on individuals having the right people. You know, HR processes don't distill these kind of right values. These values are borne out by watching people and how, you know, whether what they say is what they do. So for us, it's finding, you know, the finding the right, trying to embed certain things in our DNA, the way we do it, trying to recruit the right people that don't send us, you know, we might have come from a charity sector, now moving toward an enterprise sector, that we don't get people that are so hung up on building markets that they forget about who they're trying to serve, and in the end, who that market is, you know. So upward creep is always the challenge. It's easier to sort out. It's easier to build golf course estates and build housing for expats in Tanzania than it is for the poor. So.
What's certainly clear is that it's a pioneering. You say you're on this journey, and it's a new journey. It seems like the whole social entrepreneurial, social enterprise rubric, I suppose, seems to be quite a broad church, and there seems to be different models evolving and people using, trying to find ways to, you know, introduce this more innovative, more energetic, more entrepreneurial, but not losing the key values that are there as well, and the people that are being looked after. And it's ongoing, isn't it? And but it's very inspiring to hear, you know, of your journey. Clearly, there are lots of questions, but it's still in early days in the whole. I mean,
yes, I think in the UK too. I mean, I don't know how many. You know, I previously worked with an American organization, so it was often, you know, they have many, many little hubs and places that would talk in this particular, that would just, it's almost in their DNA.
Yeah.
Whereas here in the UK, there are not many spaces and where these kinds of things can be, you know, these kind of challenges can be discussed, so that we can develop practice, that we can actually build new benchmarks or new checklists for ourselves. I would say, give a plug for VPF, is they, in some way, they were very important in providing the legitimacy that I was seeking to pursue this. You know, it was at some stage the only people I could talk to about what we needed or trying to do was initially Leonora Fitzgibbons, who was leading the VPF at that stage, and then Mark Fisher and a number of board members. And then some people that have followed from that. I shouldn't have mentioned names because I'm going to. The other's not coming to mind that quickly.
Yes.
But they provided a kind of a, this is all right, Larry. This is what you're doing is right. And actually came and met with our staff at one stage, really challenged them. And so we're really helpful in this kind of what I call changing one's religion.
Yeah, I'm certainly going to talk to them or try and talk to them at some stage. I was thinking, I had this idea in my head of something called the ambidextrous organization. Well, it's some kind of sense of trying to get the idea of trying to bring together, not necessarily the best. I don't like to try to optimize, but, you know, trying to bring together key elements of both. different things. Yeah. But yeah, it's.
Well, sometimes there's a bipolar organization. And sometimes
Yeah.
And sometimes it's a double speak organization because if you're talking to audiences that have not made that transition themselves, you've got to be very, very careful as to what language you use. So it's a bit like, you know, talking in front of a different religious audience. You know, you can't use certain language. You've just got to be, you've got to be astute. And it's not that you're actually are being lacking integrity and being situation, you know, based, you know, changing your ethics day to day. It's not. It's just that you've got to express those in different languages. And in the UK, I feel that very much these are two different worlds that have not yet merged. We find ourselves sort of in the space in between, and seeking out other organizations to share this journey with. VPF it helps, but it can be a lonely, it can be very lonely for the person who's leading that change. Because at times you feel that you've lost your soul. You're sold to the devil, that kind of thing, you know?
Yes, the prophet word, as soon as that idea...
It's hurtful because you lose friends. I wouldn't say I've burnt bridges, but I think people see the organization in a completely different way, some of them. And you win a lot more friends than you lose, but the thing is, the losing friends that is sore nevertheless. I use the analogy of coming out. It is a coming out kind of thing, and it's not easy. When you go to school, you believe yourself into a different world. It is a different world. There's so many American accents there, but it's a little bubble. You know, it's a little Truman Show. It's not the real thing. There isn't really at the moment. And the moment you think people have actually moved in one direction, they're holding you accountable to the criteria of the old.
Oh God! Yes.
So you're still having to produce certain figures that politicians want to read.
Yes.
Despite the return on investment, you know, you've created a tenfold increase in the personal wealth of all the people you're working with, and you can show that financially. You can show that in order to validate that, but that doesn't count against how many numbers of people. You know, how many widgets how many boxes you've ticked, because an agency basically has these criteria. This is what's important for now. So as I say, you say ambidextrous. I think that is better. I think you just have to learn to use both arms. It's better. You have to learn to be multilingual, and you have to be multilingual inside your organization so that you don't lose people along the way. Yeah, you know, I still say to our organization, we are still doing the same mission. Our mission has not changed.
Yeah.
In fact, we feel more confident that we're meeting the objects of our mission now than we did before. And that's why we know we're doing the right thing.
Yes. No, it's been fascinating, and I haven't looked intensively around, but I mean, I haven't really seen much discussion about this kind of thing, because I just think it's a very interesting journey, and a brave journey as well. So,
it's you're in London. I mean, this is the cauldron of it. I mean, it's not like this in other parts of the world.
No.
You know, Americans don't have to face these things. No one actually is concerned with it.
No, they just set things up from de novo, new things out of the blue, and they don't need to.
Like LLCs, benefit corporations.
And
things here, it's like,
what? Yeah, I know.
You either get money, private sector.
Yeah, they're B Corps, and what was this? Yeah. Somebody I was interviewing the other day had a quite nice one, not just for profit. I just kind of, they're hybrid, they're kind of, but you know, fertile area, clearly. And it's good to, you know, being able to think out loud as well, I think. So
I feel privileged to be part of what you're doing, and I think that pioneers like you that are building these space, particularly in the UK, you're the first to market. I don't know of anybody else doing this, so
yes.
good for you, go for it.
Well, thank you, and I wish you the very best with your work, great. And we'll be in touch again.
Okay, Fogel.
Cheers, Ari.
Cheers then.
Yeah, bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to the Inspiring Social Entrepreneur podcast. I hope you found this interview inspiring. Please make sure to visit www.inspiringsocialentrepreneurs.com and subscribe to make sure you don't miss any future podcasts.